Thank you. So if you've been in a class that I've taught before, you know my custom is to usually start out with a reading from the Psalms. But tonight I've picked a different Old Testament book. We're going to read from 1 Kings 19 in just a little bit. It was relating to the prophet Elijah here in that passage. And I thought of the event in Elijah's life when reading in Acts 18, verse 9. It says, "And the Lord said to Paul one night in a vision, 'Do not be afraid, but go on speaking and do not be silent. For I am with you, and no one will attack you to harm you. For I have many in the city who are my people.'" So in 1 Kings 19, so in the Acts passage, God is reassuring Paul to have courage. There were many others that would be receptive to the gospel there in Corinth, his people. So back in then, 1 Kings 19, Elijah is afraid for his life. He felt alone in his faith. The event takes place after Elijah has defeated the prophets of Baal, which remember that on the mountain. And then in verse 2, Elijah's life is threatened by Queen Jezebel after all the prophets of Baal had been killed. So after this, he flees first to Beersheba, and then he asks for his life to be taken away. He's so downcast and desperate. An angel of the Lord provides him food, comes to him, and he's able then to continue on to Mount Horeb. And that's where we'll pick up and read 1 Kings 19, starting in verse 8. "And he arose, Elijah, and he ate and drank and went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights to Horeb, the mount of God. There he came to a cave and lodged in it. And behold, the word of the Lord came to him, and he said to him, 'What are you doing here, Elijah?' He said, 'I have been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the people of Israel have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword, and I, even I only, am left, and they seek my life to take it away.' And he said, 'Go out and stand on the mount before the Lord.' And behold, the Lord passed by, and a great and strong wind tore the mountains and broke in pieces of rocks before the Lord. But the Lord was not in the wind. And after the wind, an earthquake, but the Lord was not in the earthquake. And after the earthquake, a fire, but the Lord was not in the fire. And after the fire, the sound of a low whisper. And when Elijah heard it, he wrapped his face in his cloak and went out and stood at the entrance of the cave. And behold, there came a voice to him and said, 'What are you doing here, Elijah?' He said, 'I have been very jealous for the Lord, the God of hosts, for the people of Israel have forsaken your covenant, thrown down your altars, and killed your prophets with the sword, and I, even I only, am left, and they seek my life to take it away.' And the Lord said to him, 'Go, return on your way to the wilderness of Damascus, and when you arrive, you shall anoint Hazael to be king over Syria, and Jehu, the son of Nimshi, you shall anoint to be king over Israel, and Elisha, the son of Shaphat of Abel-Meholah, you shall anoint to be prophet in your place. And the one who escapes from the sword of Hazael shall Jehu put to death, and the one who escapes from the sword of Jehu shall Elisha put to death. Yet I will leave 7,000 in Israel, all the knees that have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him.'" God shows Elijah his power and tells him that he is not alone. There are 7,000 yet who have not betrayed God in Israel. We can feel alone. Elijah felt alone. We can feel overwhelmed. Paul may have felt overwhelmed by the opposition he was encountering at first in Corinth. So these cases are not the same, but it's, you know, God was there to provide strength, to provide reassurance, and to know sometimes when we feel alone, there are others out there who also stand for the same beliefs, who have the same beliefs, who are loyal to God. So we'll consider tonight a little further about Paul's situation in Acts 18, where God was there to reassure him to continue there, steadfast, through the opposition he was experiencing. Now we'll turn over to Acts 18. Of course, Acts is a book of history, and we're picking up at the end of Paul's second missionary journey, as it's so termed. Of course, that description is just a convention to help us sort of organize the events. It's not inspired terminology. Kind of bothers me a little bit. If, I was reading it, I would never have sort of codified it that way. 3 years in Ephesus, 18 months at least here. It's more than a journey to me. It's, but this is Paul's life. Not to get hung up on that minor fact. This is Paul's life now. He has been called especially to go to the Gentiles, and he spends all his time, going from place to place to do the work that the Lord has called him. I wanted to read a passage from Galatians where he recounts, his special calling. Galatians 1:15 and 16. But when he who had set me apart before I was born, and who called me by his grace, was pleased to reveal his son to me in order that I might preach him among the Gentiles. So as it is so termed, the journey, second journey, began at about Acts 15, verse 36, starting in Antioch, when Paul and Silas leave that city. They go then through the provinces, the areas as they were known then in the Roman Empire, Syria, Cilicia, Phrygia, and Galatia, so in modern-day Turkey, and they were strengthening the churches, Acts 15:41. From Troas, at the western end of that area of Turkey, the call comes, a special call for Paul to go to Macedonia. So then, Acts 16, we looked at what happened in Philippi, the first city in Macedonia that they go to. And then Acts 17, which was just about a week and a half ago, we looked at Paul's work in Thessalonica and Berea, and then Athens. So Philippi and Thessalonica and Berea, Athens, all in modern-day Greece, at the time divided up into what would have been Macedonia, the northern ones, in Achaia. So Corinth and Athens are in Achaia. So we have the Acts account, and then we looked at the corresponding epistles to those churches. So we looked at Philippians, 1st and 2nd Thessalonians most recently. So now Acts 18, we find Paul coming to Corinth. We also have mentioned Cenchrea, which is very close to Corinth. It is the port city on the east side of Corinth. And then, so Corinth, Cenchrea, and Athens, all in Achaia. So after he leaves there, he goes back to Antioch via Caesarea. And one thing I saw said possibly he even included a stop in Jerusalem. I would not have picked up on that, but when it says he goes up to see the church, there's some belief that that meant he went on to Jerusalem to see the church. So then, when you get back to Antioch, that ends what is so termed the second journey. Third journey starts right away with Paul returning to Galatia, Phrygia, and then on to Ephesus. And that'll be the stage for Acts 19, which, will come after our study of 1 Corinthians and 2 Corinthians too. So the chapter has a lot of personal names and place names. I've already mentioned many of them. We'll consider some of these in more detail as we proceed. It's something that I'm attracted to, being a geographer, and I just love names. But I wanted to just first sort of read through them, and I think it's kind of helps create a visual image in your mind if you've read through it, and you can see sort of the narration of what's going on, who are the people coming in, where they're from, and as the travel goes on, where they're going from place to place. Some of these people will be major figures in the New Testament and be found in multiple books. So the places in this chapter, we have Athens, Corinth, Pontus, Italy, Rome, Macedonia, Achaia, Syria, Cenchrea, Ephesus, Caesarea, Antioch, Galatia, Phrygia, and Alexandria. And the people, we have Paul, Aquila, Priscilla, Silas, Timothy, Jesus, Titus, Justus, Crispus, Gallio, Sosthenes, and Apollos. Most studies, maybe a lesson book or something, would break up Acts 18 into two lessons about it, verse 24, because of the transition of the location of the events from Corinth and then to Ephesus after that. So the second journey, and then Ephesus being the third journey. So I want to spend most of the time tonight in the chapter on the first part, dealing with Corinth, since we're going to be looking at 1 Corinthians next. So I'd like to read in the first 18 verses, maybe split into 1 through 11. Bill, would you mind doing that? Acts 18, 1 through 11, please.
After this, Paul left Athens and went to Corinth, and found a Jew named Aquila, native of Pontus, recently come from Italy with his wife Priscilla, because Claudius had commanded all the Jews to leave Rome. And he went to see them, and because he was of the same trade, he stayed with them and worked, for they were tent makers by trade. And he reasoned in the synagogue every Sabbath, and tried to persuade Jews and Greeks. When Silas and Timothy arrived from Macedonia, Paul was occupied with the word, testifying to the Jews that Christ was Jesus. And when they opposed and reviled him, he shook out his garments and said to them, "Your blood be on your own heads. I minister. From now on, I will go to the Gentiles." And he left there and went to the house of a man named Hippias, justice and worshiper of God. His house was next door to the synagogue. Crispus, the ruler of the synagogue, believed in the Lord, together with his entire household. And many of the Corinthians, hearing Paul, believed and were baptized. And the Lord said to Paul one night in a vision, "Do not be afraid, but go on speaking, and do not be silent, for I am with you. No one will attack you to harm you, for I have many in this city who are my people." And he stayed a year and 6 months, teaching the word of God among them.
Thank you. And Tony, would you mind reading 12 through 17?
Okay. While Gallio was pro-council of Achaia, the Jews with one accord rose up against Paul and brought him before the judgment seat, saying, "This man persuades men to worship God contrary to the law." But when Paul was about to open his mouth, Gallio said to the Jews, "If it were a matter of wrong or a vicious crime, O Jews, it would be reasonable for me to put up with you. But if there are any questions about words and names and your own law, look after it yourselves. I am unwilling to be a judge in these of these matters." And he drove them away from the judgment seat. And they all took hold of Sophanes, the leader of the synagogue, and began beating him in front of the judgment seat. And Gallio was not concerned about any of these things.
Okay. Thank you. Of course, any time, feel free to ask a question, make a comment more is what I'd prefer. A little more of sort of setting and background, and then we'll get into some of the more important stuff. Corinth was located about 40 miles west of Athens, is on a narrow isthmus joining sort of the southernmost peninsula of Greece, which is known as the Peloponnese, with the rest of Greece, which is kind of a peninsula itself anyway. But it's a narrow little strip, and it was on that, but it wasn't on any of the water on either side. So there have been many efforts over the years to put a canal there. But that's why this time Cenchrea was served as the port, because Corinth was inland. That canal eventually got built in like the 1800s. I think it was 1890. It was a very difficult works project. It was a major commercial center because of its location, both north and south in Greece, and then that cut off having to travel around the southern part of Greece just by going, and they would haul things across that narrow isthmus from one shore to the other. At this time, it's a Roman colony, but several centuries earlier, it was a Greek city that was quite known for its wickedness, especially for wanton sexuality. And so several words in the Greek language had come from the name of Corinth because of its reputation. There were many pagan temples. It was full of idolatry and evil at this time, too, of course. I've read different views saying it was still just one of the worst. Others, well, the Roman Empire was pretty bad anyway, so it wasn't really any worse than anywhere else, which is not saying much. But it had already had that reputation from earlier times as a Greek city. It was destroyed by Rome and then rebuilt by Julius Caesar, the current city that is here where Paul is visiting, recorded for us in Acts. We do know that the brethren there had come from sinful past and were still dealing with certain sins, and we'll, you know, in our study of 1 Corinthians. It was a major city, administrative seat of Achaia, and it had a large mixed population. And we see that in the people we meet in this chapter. It was very international. You know, let's say there were the Greeks, there was a large Jewish population, and there was Romans, probably other, because of its commercial role. And I think, you know, all of this is part of, you know, God's wisdom in choosing this time in history for the spread of the gospel, that there were, you know, quite a high-level mobility that we see in this population that we're reading about, which in many times in history would not have been the case. And we'll, you know, talk about how, you know, these, we're right here. So Aquila is from Pontus. That's northern Turkey. He and Priscilla were in Italy, and they come to Corinth. And they, you know, go to Ephesus, and they go back. Apollos is from Alexandria in Egypt, and we find him here. And then he would go to Ephesus. Of course, Paul is traveling all this way in, you know, the work of spreading the gospel. But there was other movements as well, and just the fact of the large Jewish settlements throughout the region made that available starting place for the teaching. So how can we generally describe Paul's time here in Corinth? It is believed that he spent at least 18 months here from verse 11, and it might have been somewhat longer just from what verse 18 says, that after this, the tribunal with Gallio, Paul stayed many days longer. From Corinth, Paul wrote the letters to the Thessalonians, it is believed, that we have just had studied. So while here, Paul stayed with Aquila and Priscilla, fellow tent makers. And as usual, he began his teaching efforts once he came to the town. Don't know if anybody was with him, if he really knew anybody. Maybe he just, you know, made that association with them because of their work. We're not told. But he began his teaching in the synagogues, as was his habit. Verse 4, he reasoned in the synagogue every Sabbath to both Jews and Greeks. So as we often see, there were Greeks who were interested in God and seeking that way that would come and to the synagogues and listen and hear and participate, I guess. So regarding the reception of the gospel here, initially there was minimal positive reception by the Jews. Timothy and Silas come and join Paul, as recorded in verse 5, perhaps a reflection of the amount of work that was yet to be done, because things do improve, but that the reception by the Jews was not much at all, because we see that after a while Paul determined to leave the synagogue and he started teaching from the house of Titus Justus. Saying it just that way, it sounds kind of, you know, casual, make a decision to do that, but it was because, as we alluded to at the beginning of class, the severe opposition that was going on to his teaching. There were some Jewish believers. We read about Crispus, who had been the ruler of the synagogue, in verse 8, whose conversion, it seems to take place with the narrative after the move to Paul's location in teaching over to the house adjacent to the synagogue. And I assume that Titus Justus is Greek. I saw other things that perhaps not. Probably the majority of the ones who came and accepted from the teaching there at his house were Gentiles, but there were Jews among them for sure. I'm just going to reread that, the 9 through 11 verses. And the Lord said to Paul one night in a vision, "Do not be afraid, but go on speaking, and do not be silent, for I am with you, and no one will attack you to harm you, for I have many in the city who are my people." So the Lord speaks to Paul in this vision that he should continue, promising that he is with Paul. Paul's not going to be hurt, and there's still many that are going to come to believe. It seems like it's, you know, talking in the future, those who would believe, his people. And it makes me recall certain times where there is explicit direction to Paul through a vision, you know, something that God is telling him, his plans for him. And of course, there may have been others, but these were told about, revealed to us in Scripture, such as the Macedonian call that came to him at Troas. So he wants to reassure Paul to stay there and not go on after this initial opposition. After a time, the Jewish resistance would increase in intensity. Paul would be brought before the proconsul Gallio, verses 12 through 17. But Gallio refused to be a judge in this matter. He didn't consider these charges, you know, relevant to him or serious of any, you know, major impact that would be negative for his jurisdiction. He even ignores the violent beating of Sosthenes, who is referred to as the ruler of the synagogue. So just a point about this, he's the second ruler of the synagogue mentioned in verse 17 in this chapter. So we have two mentioned in the chapter, first Crispus. Perhaps Sosthenes came after Crispus, because Crispus was converted. Or perhaps, as we have in Mark 5:22, plural rulers of the synagogue. There could have been more than one. They were responsible for organizing and setting up and conducting teaching in the events in the or services in the synagogue. To me, it's unclear why they beat Sosthenes. Two different theories about that. One is that perhaps he had already become a believer. You know, people speculate if he is the same Sosthenes that's mentioned in 1 Corinthians, in the greetings to the Corinthian brethren, that he had believed or would believe. Second is that he had been the sort of Jewish advocate in the case before Gallio, and in anger about them not getting any reception to their arguments, they beat him. I don't know, those are just two theories that I saw mentioned about this. Any comments? So now for the remainder of time, we're going to look through the questions, and some are more observations that I sent out ahead of time. So the first one said, "The Christ was Jesus," is the wording that I found in English Standard Version, which is what I typically use, in both verse 5 and 28. So when Silas and Timothy arrived from Macedonia, Paul was occupied with the word, testifying to the Jews that the Christ was Jesus. And then in verse 28, it's with reference to Apollos' teaching. Apollos, for he powerfully refuted the Jews in public, showing by the scriptures that the Christ was Jesus. So I asked, what could be understood by the word order in this verse? And I don't know if anything, but yeah, go ahead, Mike. Right.
The Jews are looking for this Christ, the Messiah.
Yeah.
And they're saying this Jesus is the one you've been looking for, and they've proven it through the scriptures.
Right, right. So, yeah, it just depends on which translation. I looked at some of the you know, comparing how frequently, you know, it's more common to see Jesus Christ than Christ Jesus, but you see both of them. And this was just the rendering found in the English Standard Version. I'm certainly not qualified to make a comment on the word order or any significance. Yeah.
Yeah, I think the thing here, and this is assuming, this is what I was assuming what
yeah.
we were getting at here is, and I don't mean to be too flippant here, but it's not, his name wasn't Jesus Christ, like first and last name.
Right.
This, the point that I think you're getting at here is what the real point is, that Jesus is the Christ.
Right.
Thing here. And sometimes because we're so used to saying Jesus Christ, we just kind of gloss right over.
We forget what that means.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was just 2 points, and that you really hit on. But the first was just, this was, both verses are talking about the teaching to the Jews. So it's a given that they would know who that person of the Messiah is, the Christ. So they know who that anointed one from the Old Testament prophecy would be. So that's, they have that, they understand that. So this is, Jesus is that person, like you said. So I just took that kind of angle on it, but it really is the same either way. And then the second is just that for us to remember what that means, and it's not just his name like Simon Peter, you know, it's Jesus the Messiah, and what that then means in the prophecy of being the anointed one of God. So one, I wanted to read from Luke 4, verses 18 and 19, and it's a quotation from Isaiah 61. So I would think that perhaps Paul's teaching to the Corinthians, or Apollos' teaching, he might have referred to the statement that Jesus made when he was teaching, Luke 4, 18 and 19. Sorry, I was in John. So he's Jesus in the synagogue reading from Isaiah, and the scroll of the prophet Isaiah was given to him, starting in verse 17. He unrolled the scroll and found the place where it is written, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim liberty to the captives and recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." So, any other thoughts? Okay, question two, what was the significance of Paul's statement, "Your blood be on your own heads"? That's in verse 6. So it also, we'll look at Ezekiel 33. So Paul, as we noted, had limited success with the Jews here. It was not a polite disagreement, or a polite agreement to disagree. The Jews opposed and reviled him, or the language used in the English Standard Version. So I was going to read verse 6 again. "When they opposed and reviled him, he shook out his garments and said to them, 'Your blood be on your own heads. I am innocent. From now on, I will go to the Gentiles.'" So, "Your blood be on your own heads" is a statement they would have probably known or recognized from Ezekiel. So let's turn over to Ezekiel 33. Verses 1 through 7. Russ, would you mind reading that?
Mm,
1 through 7, please, yes.
1
through 7.
"Again, the word of the Lord came to me, saying, 'Son of man, speak to the children of the people and say to them, when I bring the sword upon the land, and the people of the land take the man from their territory and make him their watchman. When he sees the sword coming on the land, if he blows the trumpet and warns the people, then whoever hears the sound of the trumpet and does not take warning, if the sword comes and takes him away, his blood shall be upon his head.'" Okay. He heard the sound of the trumpet, but did not take the warning. His blood shall be upon himself. But he who takes the warning will save his life. But if the watchman sees the sword coming and does not blow the trumpet, and the people are not warned, then the sword comes and takes one person from among them. He is taken away in his iniquity, but his blood will require at the watchman's hand. I will require at the watchman's hand. So you, son of man, I have made you a watchman for the house of Israel. Therefore you shall hear the word of my mouth and warn you.
Thank you. So, in Ezekiel's role as a watchman, as God called him, the one that he warns of the sword on the land, the judgment of the Lord, but he does not heed his warning, his blood is on his own head. The watchman had not done his duty, then it was on the watchman's. So Paul is recalling this passage, one that they would know, to note that he had discharged his duty as a watchman and told them of, you know, God's plan for them, for the gospel, the good news, but what the judgment would be if not accepted. Although not recorded here, I think we can believe that similar teaching to that recorded in chapter 17 would also be delivered here. I was going to read in Acts 17, verses 30 to 31. The times of ignorance God overlooked, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent, because he has fixed the day on which he will judge the world in righteousness by a man who he has appointed, and of this he has given assurance to all by raising him from the dead. So Paul uses similar language to that also as recorded in Acts 20:26. And in verse 6 it says, you know, from now on he would go to the Gentiles. Would Paul ever preach to the Jews again? Well, of course, very quickly we see that he does. Verse 19, same chapter in Antioch. This is, you know, specifically, I think, in reference to his teaching there in Corinth in that synagogue. Jews would still come to him in the city, but he had, you know, he was done with that effort there in the synagogue amongst those who were not willing or interested in hearing. And I think it's, you know, we can think in the larger scale that it's also the fulfillment of God's plan to make salvation to all, available to all who would hear and receive. It's, you know, that we see that common theme as the Jews have rejected, so it's going out to all nations. We see that Crispus and his household believed. As I said, it ended Paul's work in the synagogue. Any thoughts or comments? Yeah, Mike. Right, it's not what they wanted to hear. Yeah, good reminder. In Apollos' teaching, that the second sort of chance says that he was able to powerfully refute the Jews. You know, I thought that was interesting. Was he able to do something Paul wasn't? And sometimes one person can have a different effect than someone else. But we're actually not told if in any there were converts, but he was able to refute them. So question three. It's more of this observation. I threw in a question there that doesn't have too much merit, I don't think. But Aquila and Priscilla appear in several locations throughout our study. I've already kind of gone through them. The first appearance is here in Corinth, and then we find them in Ephesus and later in this chapter, and then referred to in 1 Corinthians 16. And then later they're back in Rome, where they originally had come from before Corinth. And then they seem to be connected with Ephesus again in 2 Timothy 4. The early verses, when Paul meets them and says that he stays with them, it doesn't explicitly call them Christians. It calls Aquila a Jew. But how do we know they were believers? No.
Okay, that's
yeah. We don't know. Yeah.
We don't know if they were Jews and he taught them. Yeah, but you're right. We're not given their background.
That's right. So it could have been, but maybe not. We aren't told about their conversion, when or where it occurred. But we know because they would later work in the churches and teach Paulus that at some point they were. And that's really all I was getting at. But sometimes just being careful about the words that are used and making assumptions. We sometimes just don't know what we can think about, you know, when those things might happen and what we can use other verses to show. Okay. We won't read the rest of the chapter just because of time. We'll go through then the last two here in the 5 minutes. So question four, what would have been involved in Paul strengthening all the disciples? So this is him going back through Galatia, Phrygia. This would also involve the cities of Derbe, Iconium, and Lystra, and the other Antioch of Pisidia. Galatians 6:9 uses similar language. I wrote down the wrong one, but let's look at Acts 15:44. That also is wrong. But this Greek word literally translates to abundance and to abound, which made me think of 1 Thessalonians 3:12. Hopefully I wrote that one down right. Says, and may the Lord make you increase and abound in love for one another and for all, as we do for you. And then the next chapter, 1 Thessalonians 4:1. Finally then, brothers, we ask and urge you in the Lord Jesus that as you received from us how you ought to walk and to please God, just as you are doing, that you do so more and more. Paul loves and cares for these brethren that he has taught, has been with, has spent time there. So he's wanting to encourage them to do what he can to show them that, you know, he's there, whether to answer questions, to bring messages from others, to, you know, reinforce teaching, to show his love for them. So perhaps we can all think, what would strengthen us, you know, if we knew someone who was, you know, from the past that was coming through, how, you know, would that strengthen us? I think just, you know, seeing that association and renewing that and talking about the experiences he had had in the other places where he was teaching and growing the church, growing the community. Perhaps, you know, just hearing about the gospel spread in Greece would be an encouragement for them. Any thoughts? Then final, the question five. So we have Apollos in the last four verses. He's spoken of very highly. So I wonder, what is Paul's purpose in extolling this man's qualities? So I had several thoughts here, just to go through how he's described. He was an eloquent man. He was competent in the scriptures, fervent in the spirit. He spoke and taught accurately. He spoke boldly, and he greatly helped, you know, those. Is the purpose of these words to extol him above others? Well, no, certainly not. But he was certainly making an impact. And these words are spirit-inspired. There was a purpose for them. As we see in, when we'll get into 1 Corinthians, some may have associated greater things with him than they should have, maybe because he was such a powerful presence and speaker, and that can be in danger of that. But we should acknowledge the strengths of others and be grateful for the blessings that they can provide. But we also know that we're all part of the body and we don't have the same abilities, and everyone plays their own role. So there's no greater attributes of someone than someone else. It's certainly not here for anyone to be envious or jealous if you see someone extolled, but do, you know, be grateful for that, and so that it can work for the good of the gospel. As with so many lessons, you know, attitude is everything at the heart of how we take what can be said and done.
What's interesting too, I think, is wonderfully as he's described that he still needed to be taken aside and explained more accurately. And I think that's a warning to all of us, no matter how well you think you understand things or how well you may express things, you still need to be ready to learn.
Very good. Yeah, thank you. And I think maybe that's part of the reason. I mean, even though he had these great qualities, there was something missing that someone else was able to fill in. Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
That kind of dovetailing a little bit there is, like, when you look at these passages here, it's like the first part of it, you know, Luke's writing here, and it's kind of giving us some background on Apollos that leads into the situation with Aquila and Priscilla. But then after that, after he's kind of taught things more accurately and he shows his humble attitude, even as capable a person as he is, then he's like, hey, I want to go over to Corinth. The brethren are encouraging, and then they're the ones who write a letter for him to take with him so that people at Corinth will know, hey, here's somebody who needs to be of help. And probably to mention some of these, maybe, you know, qualities, or at least show how he can be a help to them.
Right.
So they're giving him some credibility, building him up, encouraging him.
Good. Thank you. All right. Thank you for your contributions.